Hi, I'm KSL's Debbie Worthen. 4 years ago, my son Asher was diagnosed with autism. After getting our footing, we decided it was time to celebrate the news with all of you. And that's how Celebrating the Spectrum was born. Each week, we consult with the experts and others who are learning to navigate life with a loved one who has special needs. This is a place where we find hope, look for solutions, and connect with those working to create a better world of inclusion. Thanks for joining us for today's episode of Celebrating the Spectrum. Now, part of the journey of learning about autism after your child gets a diagnosis is the deep dive into research for information and resources. Well, as I was scrolling through Instagram, an influencer with autism said this book is a must read. So I ordered it immediately. The book is titled Uniquely Human, A Different Way of Seeing Autism. And the author is today's guest, Dr. Barry M. Prezant. Dr. Prezant, thank you so much for being with us today.
It's my pleasure to be with you.
I want to read a few of your credentials. Now, if we wanted to take a full hour, I could read all of them. But let me just give our listeners a little bit of background here. So Dr. Prezant has 50 years experience as a clinical scholar, consultant, researcher, and program consultant to children and older persons with autism spectrum disorders and related neurodevelopmental disabilities and their families. Prezant is recognized as one of the world's leading scholars in autism spectrum disorder. So I want to start with that because I always want to build the credibility of our guests, and your reputation precedes you. So thank you for coming on. When I started reading the book, Uniquely Human, the first part of it, and it was the acknowledgement page, and it said, to all individuals with autism and their families, in the hope that this book will help them gain what they so deserve, understanding and respect. I knew we were going to be friends.
Yeah.
So in your writings, I really got the impression that you have connected on a very important level with so many families and people impacted by autism. What has it been like over the years working with and meeting so many of these people?
Well, it's been my life's journey. One of the things I say right away, and I especially say this to younger professionals, is, understand that, getting to know autistic people and families and watching families go through their journeys, watching kids grow up to be young adults, that's going to have an impact on your life, just in terms of understanding the diversity of humankind. Not only that, I think some of the coolest people I know are on the spectrum, and I mean that respectfully.
Right.
I mean, talk about thinking outside of the box, talk about really trying to overcome challenges and struggles in a world that maybe, as many autistic people say, in a world that wasn't necessarily designed for them, that was designed for non-autistic people. So the journey's been fabulous for me. It started out as a teenager, working in summer camps, and I still look back on those years, those early years, as the formative years and the years that really fueled my interest and passion to be doing this for 50 some odd years.
Yeah, talk about that summer camp, because you start with that in the book.
I was a kid growing up in New York City, in a lower middle class family, and my father was able to get me a job working in this print shop in Manhattan. I remember it was noisy and greasy, and my girlfriend was working upstate New York, as we say, outside of the city.
Okay.
And it was a camp for, she was a musician, and she was a music teacher for children and adults with disabilities. And she said, Barry, we need another counselor. We just fired one. Could you come up? And I said, oh, God, yeah, I'd love to get out of the city. First time out of the city for me.
Uh-huh.
I was 17. And I landed in this camp, which, looking back now, quality-wise wasn't the greatest.
Mm-hmm.
But the people I met, my campers, I just kind of fell in love with working with children and adults. And also, I was beginning school in psycholinguistics, so I was very interested in language and language development. So there was this intellectual interest as well. Why did these people have such problems communicating?
Mm-hmm.
And that carried me through into speech pathology and communication disorders and 6 more years of working at summer camps.
What year was that?
That was 19. I'm trying to always try to remember because I went to Woodstock. And Woodstock is 1969, and I think this was probably, it was the summer of 69.
Oh, okay, yeah. There's a song about that, isn't there?
Yeah.
All right, so things have changed so much in that time. What was it about those people at that camp, those kids, that made you want to learn more? Because you describe in your book how you just enjoyed them so much.
Yeah, I think a lot of it was, and actually one of the themes of Uniquely Human is this, that I wanted to understand why they did things that they did. So there was a young man named Steven, I remember, and he had this uncanny ability to wake up in the middle of the night. That wasn't the uncanny part.
But I'm like, I have that too.
He would put on the new James Taylor album that just came out, and he would always be able to find the song In My Mind, I'm Going to Carolina. And so at 2 or 3 in the morning every night, he would go over to the old record player, find the song, turn it on, and rock and sing along with James Taylor. And he had an incredible memory for music. So that was like, wow, that's something else here.
Right.
But there was, I could tell you so many stories of the individual kids. I talk at the beginning of my book about this adult on the spectrum named Uncle Eddie. And Uncle Eddie just went on complimenting everybody all the time. So he would come up to me, and I think I gave this example in the book, come up to me and say, Barry, you look so handsome today.
Right.
And I was interacting with people who behaved in very different ways, and I wanted to understand that, even though I was finding even some of the counselors, the senior counselors, were trained to have the kids stop doing a lot of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually ended up being my doctoral dissertation a number of years later, in understanding why a lot of people on the spectrum repeat speech, which is called echolalia. I was interested both. I was fulfilled emotionally helping out these kids and adults, but I was fulfilled intellectually as well.
Right.
In that it drove me to want to study what was going on and have a different way of looking at these individuals. Yes.
Well, and what's amazing for me when I read your work, it's so refreshing to see someone who has so much knowledge, who studied this for years, and really has a love for the people themselves. You don't ever go into this like, we need to fix these autistic kids. And I want to, I want to talk about that, because in the time frame that you started your studies, that was sort of the mindset. These kids are broken. We need to fix this. We need to fix this problem. How did you, or why did you think, no, they're not broken, we don't need to fix them, we need to understand them? What was your thought process there?
I was so fortunate from very, very early on to choose a focus on child and human development in my studies. So I was in programs for, I'm a speech language pathologist, and I was in programs for speech and language. But when I went up for my doctorate, almost all my coursework was in developmental psychology. Now, why is this important? Because if you look at every person as an evolving human being, it gets you away from, and the term that I started using a number of years ago, is it gets you away from pathologizing the person. You want to understand why they do what they do. How does that fit into where this person is in their developmental journey, in language, in emotional development? So I was very fortunate. So many people in the field started out in trying to fix kids and pathologizing kids. And actually some very good people in the field now say, oh, but then I learned that was the wrong way mid-career. I never had to make that change because I had wonderful mentors, and my studies were all about child and human development. I studied multicultural aspects of development. How is it that kids growing up in Africa in an agricultural society can be emotionally healthy and as healthy emotionally as kids growing up in upper class families in the United States?
Mm-hmm.
And it asked the answer, by the way, is responsive caregiving. That when caregivers are highly responsive to children, then children gain trust, they feel grounded, and they take risks in development. You know, they're just good, solid individuals. So I was always exposed to what is called developmental approaches to understanding development. At the time, one of the founders of applied behavior analysis, Dr. Lovaas, you know, was saying, well, when kids repeat speech, that's psychotic speech. We have to punish that. Mm-hmm. Or if they flap their hands, we have to punish that. And unfortunately, you know, that led to not only a lot of problems, but now adults on the spectrum are saying, some are saying they were traumatized right. by those kinds of
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I don't want to get into the weeds too much on that part. Mm-hmm. But the point is, people like the late Dr. Lovaas and some of his colleagues, and I'm going to be quite frank, knew nothing about child and human development.
Interesting.
They knew about changing behavior using operant conditioning approaches. But when I look back now even and look at some of the writings from that school of thought back then, I say, oh my goodness, you know, a master's student in speech and language knows more about language development than what these people were saying back then. You cannot respect an individual child or a person and the challenges they have as well as their strengths unless you know something about child and human development. And that's what I taught and continue to teach, you know, in all my workshops and when I teach university students, yes.
So you also have a podcast called Uniquely Human. Let's just give that a huge shout out. It's so amazing. And one thing you were talking about that I was listening to was you were saying, you know, follow that instinct, that parental instinct, and even when the experts are telling you things. And I almost cried when you talked about parents saying, well, I'm not an expert. I'm just the parent of a kid with autism. And you are the expert when you're a parent of a kid with autism, you know, and I really loved that so much because I can't tell you how many times I've gone into meetings and IEP meetings and I just feel so inadequate. It's like, I don't know. You guys are the professionals. I don't know. Our pediatrician, who I love, he said, if I ever tell you anything in here or if you ever go into a school that you're looking at for your son and you just do not feel right about it, it's like that does not feel right. He's like, you need to trust that. First and foremost, that is what you need to trust for your son. And I love you were saying that same thing.
Well, I would say just from that one example, you have a wonderful pediatrician because there are many experts who write out prescriptions for different therapies. And that's not what supporting a family is about. Supporting a family, if you are a professional, is about being a resource and let the parents make the decision as to what the best fit is for their child and their family. Now, granted, some parents are going to say, well, you really are the expert, and I don't know what's best. And I like what you just said. It's kind of go back to your gut, you know, and then say what feels right. Or if you take a path that as you proceed down the path and you say this just doesn't feel right for us, mm-hmm. you know, being able to say that, and that's big. But there are still so many pediatricians out there who believe one approach works, and they've been indoctrinated into that, even though they don't know a lot about autism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the war stories that I hear every week from parents about, in some cases, parents are angry. They feel they've been misled. Why didn't they tell me that there are other ways to support my child mm-hmm. or different approaches? But let me say where this comes from. As with learning about child and human development early on, I also was exposed to parents very early on. And I used to go to the parent meetings of, in the old days, was called the National Society for Autistic Children. That's the Autism Society of America. One of my professors used to take me to those meetings. And I was put in a setting where I heard parents pretty much uncensored talking about their experiences. And that, by the way, led to our parent retreat weekend, which we've been doing for 25 years now. I do it. My wife is a clinical psychologist and a nurse in the Harvard Medical School. And her name is Dr. Elaine Meyer. And her work doesn't focus so much on autism, but it focuses on the parent experience of having a child with medical illnesses. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of overlap there. So my point is that the parents who I became close with in the late 60s and into the early 70s were the ones, and one said this to me, it's in my book, you know, the professionals we feel most comfortable with are the ones who don't judge us. They're the ones who join us on our journey. And I've taken that to heart my whole career. I am not there to dictate, to judge. I will give an opinion if I'm asked for my opinion about a different approach or whatever it might be, but I'm there to kind of bear witness to the journey that the parents are and hope to be a guide if parents want me to be a guide.
Yeah, and it's kind of that saying, people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And that's so true. As a parent of a child with autism, you do feel judged a lot by a lot of different arenas. So in this book, you have four different ideas. And the first, which I love so much, and that is ask why. And I think as you send your kid into school and you start getting the reports each day of how the day went, you know, oh, meltdown over this or this happened or this happened. My question always, and I have sat in IEP meetings where they're saying, oh, well, he's saying this because you're making him feel this way. And in my mind, I'm like, no, he's saying that because that's a quote from the movie Twister, you know, and I, you know, you don't want to be combative. And I never want this to be combative or angry, because the whole idea is celebration and celebrating the spectrum, because I feel like that is so valid with what little I know about my 6-year-old son at this point. But the asking why is, there's always a reason something is happening. So tell me how you came up with that.
Again, let's go way back to summer camp, but a little bit beyond that, my doctoral dissertation. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I was interested in language, being a speech and language pathologist. As I mentioned, echolalia is fairly common, you know, in speaking autistic people and kids. So at the time, what the research and literature was saying, primarily from a behavioral orientation, was that it was meaningless parroting. Mm-hmm. And I'm working with kids and a classroom for autistic kids. That was back in Buffalo Children's Hospital, you know, lifetime ago. And I'm saying, wait a second. You know, when you say, do you want to go out? And the child says, do you want to go out? And they run to the door. They're saying, yes, I want to go out. Mm-hmm. Or if you say, would you like something to eat? And the child says, something to eat, a cookie, where they echo and repeat. So I'm saying, wait a second. This is functional communication. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's a little unconventional because you don't expect a 6 or an 8 or 10-year-old to repeat speech that much. So the bottom line was, I did a videotape analysis over a year of kids who used a lot of echolalia. I analyzed 1,009 echoes, mm-hmm. and found out that often the kids understood what they were saying, or they were using it. The technical term is they were using it for different communicative functions. But the research at that time was saying, discourage it, tell kids to stop. Mm-hmm. It's psychotic speech. It's meaningless parroting. So that was the first big why that I asked. It was the why are kids echoing? Mm-hmm. And that expanded in our work to why does he rock? Why does she flap her hands? Okay. And there are so many whys that have been pointed out, you know, that we need to look at in people with autism. But again, the approach was, okay, well, if he rocks too much, it looks strange. Tell him to stop rocking, mm-hmm. all right? So many things we could talk about. If he sits and puts his hands over his ears and goes, tell him hands down. The why there might be the environment's too noisy, mm-hmm. or maybe I didn't sleep well the night before and I really can't sit in my morning circle time or meeting. And eventually the field started looking at the why, and now autistic adults are telling us all the whys that they do things.
Right.
And actually that was, you know, I've been so fortunate that the book has been embraced by autistic people of all.
Right. That's so great. Yeah, that's a huge accolade. Mm-hmm.
And a big reason it's been embraced is they respected the fact that I emphasize on asking why, because many of them say, nobody asked why I did that. They just tried to stop me mm-hmm. from doing it. Some cases they punished me. So in our latest podcast, which is not out yet, we interviewed Lauren Ober, who's an award-winning podcast person. She's a journalist.
Okay.
She's as funny as can be. A little plug, she has a new podcast coming out called The Loudest Girl in the World.
Love it.
The reason I'm talking about this, she spoke on our podcast about how she loved to talk and she would talk incessantly about stuff. And the teacher in the classroom took a big cardboard box, like from a refrigerator, and surrounded her desk with it in the classroom to get her to stop doing that. Now, she was diagnosed just a couple of years ago in her 40s. But she spoke about a lot of the things that happened to her because people didn't ask why. They just judged her behavior and tried to get her to stop doing things that made other people feel uncomfortable.
You talk about making other people feel uncomfortable. I think my husband and I have had a huge learning curve and a lot of growth because we have realized some of the things we wanted our son to stop doing was because it was embarrassing us. And when you take a step back and realize, stop being so prideful. Why do I care what these total strangers think about what my son is doing? He is having so much fun. He's loving this. He's just embracing who he is. It is a beautiful way to look at the world.
Yes. And I think it's so important, you know, for us to bend over backwards to try to understand the child's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So if a child is staring at his fingers or maybe singing a song over and over again and it looks like it's joyful, and somebody says to the child, hands down, no talking.
Mm-hmm.
Then, and especially if that happens over and over and over again, any human being is going to feel either lousy about themselves or going to feel the world is not a fun place to be in if they're restricted from doing things that actually might be either fun or, as we say in the book, emotionally regulating for them or helpful for them.
Right, right.
And again, just going back to adults on the spectrum embracing Uniquely Human, it's because so many of them feel, you know, you may not be autistic, but you're putting your finger on it right here. Yep.
Right, right. No, for sure. And I love that you talked about the study with why were kids who were so poor, impoverished, living in Africa, mentally, emotionally healthy, just as healthy as those living in affluent neighborhoods, and that trust and the parenting. And that, I think, is just really the key. All right. So we have to take a quick break. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to talk about these other three ideas in Uniquely Human, and we have a lot more to cover. So stay with us. To Celebrating the Spectrum. We are talking to Dr. Barry Prezant, and our producer Ryan was giving me the little nod, like I need to say something too. And he was really, this was resonating with him, what you were saying about the why. So Ryan, what were you thinking here?
Well, I thought it was really brilliant you talking about no one ever asked the why and the importance of asking the why. And what I was thinking in my mind was I learned a lot about asking why in college. You know, we learn about asking why professionally. But do we ever really learn about asking why to our families, to our children?
Mm-hmm.
And in this context of autistic people, but also just to all of our families.
Absolutely. And it is so important. But we have to create the space to ask why, because sometimes what happens is if we judge before trying to understand why a person's saying that or behaving in that way, then that allows us to dismiss it. Okay. So, you know, if a teenager is kind of quote unquote arguing with you, well, do we say, well, why are you upset about that? As opposed to stop arguing. If we just judge it as, oh, well, she's being or he's being argumentative, let's just stop it.
Right.
As opposed to, is something going on in school today that upset you? You just seem to be very edgy right now.
Right. I think a lot of the times it's a let's get this to stop. Let's get the yelling to stop instead of asking why.
Absolutely. And especially if you are kind of emotionally upset. And if there is that spiral of either anger or anxiety, we're much less likely to think about the why.
Yes.
We want the person to stop or get out of here. I can't listen to you anymore. As opposed to, you know, I'm so sorry you're feeling so terrible. I wish you wouldn't say that to me, but why do you feel so terrible?
Mm-hmm.
It's... I think a challenge, a lifetime challenge for all of us. Yeah,
I agree. Okay, the second of those four different ideas in Uniquely Human is teach telepathy. Talk about that.
Yeah, one of the issues that a lot of autistic people face is kind of really understanding the perspective of another person, or how does another person feel about this? And that little phrase comes from a story that I'll share with you very quickly. And it was a young man, a teenager many years ago, who was having problems carrying on conversations, and he felt like he just could not be in the flow of conversation. And he said, well, I know why I can't. And I asked him why, and he said, because you people who are not autistic know how to read each other's minds. So his explanation was that social communication and conversation seemed so easy for other people because we could read each other's minds, but he didn't know how to do that. So teaching telepathy is maybe not the best way of saying it, but it's to help people on the spectrum to understand that other people might feel differently, have a different perspective, to help them understand why non-autistic people in many cases do what they do and say what they do. Mm-hmm. Another very quick story. This was a middle school child I was consulting to, and he thought that all of his teachers hated him after the first few weeks of middle school. And I met with him and I asked him why. And the nice thing about so many people on the spectrum, if you could ask them a direct question, you get a direct answer.
Yeah.
And he said to me, well, all my teachers hate me. And I said, well, it's only the second week of school. Why do you think all your teachers hate you? And he said, well, that's because they're teaching stuff I'm not interested in, and not one of them likes the New England Patriots. And
that's
he
great.
Interpreted that as because he didn't understand that, wait a second, some of his friends in school also may not like what's being taught, you know, and maybe some of his friends in school are Patriots fans, but they understand that in school the teachers are not there to teach about the Patriots.
Right, yeah.
Unless it's a cool teacher. So the teaching telepathy piece is trying to understand kind of the perspective, emotional perspective, the cognitive perspective, where another person's coming from, so you don't misinterpret
right.
what's going on.
And yeah. Is that something that can be taught?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I have friends, and I didn't mention this yet. I mean, one of the huge areas of my personal growth as a professional is I hang around and hang out with a lot of autistic people. Mm-hmm. I have close friends
right.
who are autistic. And some of them, and this is going to be a surprise to you and maybe blow the mind of some of your listeners. Some of my friends on the spectrum, I mean, are more sensitive and more insightful as to how a person might be interpreting a situation than some of my so-called typical or neurotypical friends. And if you ask me why, if you say, wait a second, I thought the neurology in autism doesn't allow for that. Mm-hmm. Many people on the spectrum, especially those that have more advanced language and have a lot of support in their lives, they work really hard at understanding themselves and understanding other people. They literally study that. And that develops an insight that some of us don't have because they work so hard at understanding, this is difficult for me and I need to practice it. I need to read about it. So just another quick story. This is in the book. A number of years ago, I was consulting to a three-year-old in a home, and the dad wasn't there, but he was coming home from work. And the mom said to me, oh, my husband will be home soon. By the way, he's on the spectrum. He has Asperger's. And he was an investment banker in New York City. Okay. This is up in Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
And he comes home, and he says to me, well, I think my wife mentioned that I've been diagnosed with Asperger's. And he just said right away, he said, I want to tell you, you know, economics, numbers, that comes to me like breathing air. Understanding people, I need to study this. I need to read books about understanding facial expressions. I need to learn how to read the subtle cues that other people are giving. Now, he's one of these people that could pass for, in most cases, not obviously autistic.
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But I hear that again from a lot of friends I have. And a lot of these friends are giving back to the autism community now, that they say they work so hard at it. That's why they become good at it, almost like from a understanding cognitive perspective. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's amazing. I love that. Celebrate enthusiasm. This, I love this. And, you know, and you could say obsessions or high focus areas of interest, that kind of thing. I love how you say celebrate enthusiasms. When I've done this autism acceptance assembly at my son's school, I start out with some pictures of like Elon Musk and who knows what a Tesla is, you know, and they're all like, oh, we have a Tesla. And it just kind of puts it in a different realm for them. But talk about the celebrate enthusiasm and why this is so important for parents and for all of us.
Yeah. And this is a wonderful example of looking through a different lens. So, you know, let me give an example. We have a little expressive art summer camp that we had in June. And at the end of the summer camp, a young man who, I think he's 12, absolutely loves dinosaurs, knows everything about all of those eras that I can't pronounce, you know, Paleolithic and all of that stuff. And he was about to go on a trip with his mother that they do every summer, using their camper, going around the country to archaeological sites where dinosaurs were found, dinosaur bones were found. He could tell you anything, okay? But it's become such a part of his life, and it's led to other interests in science. Mm-hmm. But we could go on and on about when we find something that a child or a person on the spectrum loves, it opens all kinds of doors for learning. It opens all kinds of doors for building trust with mm-hmm. that person. Now, going back to what we said earlier, in some cases, as you said, these were the term that I use is pathologized. They were thought of as bad stuff.
Right.
Okay, we got to stop that obsessive behavior. We got to stop that incessant talking about that topic. What is now being found is that not only in terms of a person's mental health, but something as concrete as employment, that if we respect and provide the opportunities to learn and build upon those, as many people now on the spectrum say, the deep interests, mm-hmm. not obsessions,
right.
deep interests. Let's go with the enthusiasms. It makes a person feel good about themselves. And by the way, is this so unusual? Let's say you go to a party and there are a lot of people there you don't know, and you talk back and forth, and all of a sudden the other person says, oh, I love to ski in Colorado. Oh, you like to ski in Colorado? I love it as well.
Right.
We look to connect with people over those common interests, and then we get excited about connecting with that person.
Why is it so important for parents to do that with their kids?
Well, first, the first step is that parents need to push back on some professionals who will make a deep interest something that you shouldn't encourage, mm-hmm. okay? Something that you shouldn't let your child talk about, okay? It's important for the trust reason, developing relationship reason. Another example, there's a wonderful YouTube video from the UK about a youngster who became very interested in flags. And he memorized all the flags of almost all the countries in the United States. And then his parents started getting copies of the flags. And so he would put it all over his bedroom, put it all over the yard. And then he developed this routine of raising a different country flag every morning on the flagpole in their yard. And all the neighbors were really interested in it. And they started coming over and asking him questions. And they found out it wasn't just the flag. He knew a lot about the culture of the country, the languages of the country. And the mom on this video said, oh, I think they first came over thinking that he was into the World Cup, but it had nothing to do with the World Cup. He just loved the flags. And so what was so beautiful about that it was that, and they started posting on the Facebook page of the town, and that people, when they would see this youngster in the town, they would speak to him. Any new flags? What's going on? It made the connections happen as opposed to, and unfortunately it happens. It still happens. Oh, he's interested in flags. Well, he needs to earn time to be focused on flags.
Right. Mm-hmm.
One thing that we talk about in our educational model, which is called the CERTS model, is kids should never have to earn what is joyful and regulating for them.
Right.
We don't do that with typically developing kids. Now, yeah, we have special privileges, mm-hmm. you know, to go the extra mile about something that a child loves to do. But too often it happens in programs for autistic kids that everything that they like has to be earned.
Right. That's stupid.
It is. And it's something we would not do with other kids.
Right.
So the enthusiasms piece, it opens up so many opportunities for learning, for parents connecting with their kids, for brothers and sisters who are not autistic connecting with mm-hmm. their kids. And as kids get older, joining special clubs, science clubs, Lego clubs. So what becomes an incessant topic for a child? Oh, he drives me crazy. All he wants to talk about is his Legos. That same child joins a Lego club and he's the top expert in the club.
Yeah, or becomes an engineer and the best engineer out there. You know, talk about the story with the license plates, the pictures of the license plates. I love that in the book.
Yeah, great story. One of my favorite teachers. There was a young man who, by the way, graduated high school last year. And this story was about when he was much, much younger in elementary school. He loved just spontaneously when he walked through the parking lot of the school, he would memorize the license plate and what car it was on. Okay, so it's the blue Volvo sedan and the license plate number is so-and-so. The teacher at this time was trying to teach him to read, but using things that he wasn't interested in. So he would lose attention. He would start talking about other things. And then what she said, I kind of suggested it, but she took the ball and ran with it. I said, well, what does he love? What does he talk about a lot? She told me the license plate. And she, I said to her, well, where can we go with that?
Right.
And she said, you know, I think what we could do, I'd have to get permission of the teachers, but let's find out which license plate went with which car and which staff member that belonged to. And then she had them she had this youngster interview them about, oh, you know, what do you like to do? What are your hobbies? How many kids do you have? And then they developed a PowerPoint presentation that he gave during an assembly with the permission to show how much he knew, but it gave him the social opportunity to speak to people, and it really capitalized on his strength and his enthusiasm. So what seemed to be this quirky thing, he memorized license plates that went with cars, became this big, big project that he had written. He wrote it up, and he read it and he was thrilled to be able to, and this is development of literacy skills, of typing into PowerPoint who the person was, what they loved to do, and he was reading it all to everybody. So this became the fire in his belly to learn to read
right.
Much more complex.
I loved that story because it was, well, you and that teacher that you said who ran with the idea, figuring out a way to make this work and that was huge. I mean, look at all of the good that came from that, not just for him, but for the student body and the teachers, too. Right. Okay.
Exactly. That's what we're after. Yeah.
It is. Okay. So find it. What is that? Is this like the it factor that we talk about?
Yeah. Yeah. This is the it factor. And this is a story that I had actually learned from a parent. And I was doing a workshop in Vancouver, British Columbia many years ago. And we were talking about during my workshop, don't you just see some people who know how to connect with people on the spectrum, where others, it's uncomfortable, they're both getting anxious, it's just not working. And this mom raised her hand and she goes, well, in our family, we call it the it factor, that there are some people, unfortunately, not enough, but there are some people who just get it. They know how to communicate with my son. My son feels comfortable with them and they really do well together. Okay. And she's talking about instructional assistants or paraprofessionals in schools.
Mm-hmm.
And she also spoke about, you know, but he's had a couple of paraprofessional aides that when he would, at the beginning of the school year, he would come home more anxious than he had left in the morning. And she said, you know, those people, you know, should not be working with our kids. And I said to her, oh yeah, those are the it-less people, right? But she also spoke about the it-like people, meaning that they want to help, they feel a little uncomfortable, but they want to learn from parents and they want to learn how to really support a student well. And she said, you know, I would take an it-like person anytime because they got the approach and the attitude and the open-mindedness of wanting to develop a relationship with my son. And I've consulted and I've seen it-less people where usually an it-less person with a child with autism, it's all about discipline.
Mm-hmm.
Why aren't you listening to me? You need to sit down, okay? You're going to go to timeout. And it's more about their feeling a lack of control over the student than it is about helping the student. So the it factor has to do with people, but the it factor also has to do with classrooms and programs. I've been working with a family just recently that in their part of the country, they could not find a school for their six-year-old, that it was all discipline-oriented. Mm-hmm. They felt they didn't understand how special he was, and he had some real strengths. This is a student, and the strengths were being ignored. And they were looking for an it school. You know, they were looking for a place that they felt would get him, would respect him. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm the last professional to say, oh, just pick up and move anywhere in the country because the school could change, the teacher could change. But they had the resources, but they were interested in, you know, trying to find schools with a different philosophy that they felt was the best fit for their child. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the it factor also goes for that.
Oh.
And it gets back to the very beginning of what you said, mm-hmm. looking at your gut and saying, is this the right school? Is this the right person?
Right.
Is this the right teacher? So important.
Yeah. So my son started, he went into mainstream public school last year, and he would tell me, oh, he loves the aide Crystal, loves Crystal. So I had not met Crystal. So I go walking in one day, we'd had a bad morning, we're late, and we're walking to the hall, and this woman says, Asher, hi. And she's like, I'm Crystal. And I'm like, Crystal is a tall brunette bombshell. I'm like, no wonder Asher loves working with Crystal. But I thought it was so funny. But what you were saying, you know, the it-like people, I feel like I have been that person. I have been a little bit uncomfortable, but want to learn, and now just shoved into this world that, you know, I'm in my late 40s. We had no exposure to any of it when I was a kid. And that is one of the reasons we started the podcast. I want that changed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but that it factor, that is everything for your child in a school.
Yeah. Oh, and now, if I might say, now you got it because you understand. From your experience, mm-hmm. you can give back to others. And that's so important.
Yeah, it is. It is. I feel like it is important for those of us who are learning so much to share what we've learned and keep the conversations going. So we only have a few more minutes. And this, I feel like, is a really important question. How have things changed over the decades of your career when it comes to the perception and how we're embracing diversity, how we are embracing inclusion? You called it a climate of a tsunami. Talk about that.
Yes. Yeah. And well, the changes have been dramatic, especially in the last 10 to 15 years. And I will say without hesitation, it's primarily due to autistic people being at the helm and saying, this is my experience. This is what is helpful for me. This is what is not helpful for me. I mean, even at a legal level, the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, which thankfully endorsed my book because they're very critical about what they will endorse.
Right.
Wonderful people, professionals, all on the spectrum, to my understanding. Even their legal department has lawyers on the spectrum. And now we just interviewed on our podcast about a month and a half ago, a developmental pediatrician and family practitioner who's on the spectrum from Vermont. So the big change is embracing identity, but we're still learning how to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, I talk about the autism bubble, those of us who read within autism or neurodiversity, and those of us who go to conferences. But it's still mainstream society that we really have to get to. And it's not just the stories of, you know, a few years ago, the autistic kid on the basketball team who never plays, but they allowed him to play and he scores 6 3-pointers in a row. It's really interesting. A lot of autistic people say, you know, enough with this inspiration porn.
Yeah, I've heard that too, the disability porn.
Let's talk about everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
And helping people on the spectrum of quality of life. Yes, those stories are good,
right?
But they're rare. And let's go back to just understanding every person as an individual who needs to be respected, who needs to be loved, where we have to understand, you know, that they need to be supported in their sense of self emotionally as much as any human being does. And let's be sensitive to that. So this is, and you know, one other aspect that I'm very involved in is understanding that this can be done in so many creative ways. So theater programs, the Miracle Project out of Los Angeles, which I'm involved with, Spectrum Theater Ensemble in Providence, which is a professional theater company with both autistic and neurotypical actors, including playwrights who are autistic. So now it's expanded beyond, okay, let's have good educational programs to help autistic people. It's kind of like in the flow of life through music, through the arts, through meaningful employment. Let's make sure we are seeing the strengths and the contributions of autistic people. So important. And some of you, some listeners not familiar with this might say, oh, the contributions of autistic people. Well, you know, you spoke about Tesla, but you spoke about Tesla in reference to Elon Musk.
Right.
Nikola Tesla was on the spectrum.
Interesting.
The person who invented alternating current was, if you look at it, at an historical biography of him, I don't have time to tell you the story of actually going on a Nikola Tesla tour in Zagreb, Croatia, a number of years ago. And the person on the tour spoke about how unique he was, and he always had the same thing to eat in the same bar every day at 5:15 every day. And he was considered a genius, brilliant. And then he moved to the United States. But the point is, and let me plug my dear friend Steve Silberman, the book Neurotribes, where he talks about the history of neurodiversity up to the present and what's happening. Some of the most major contributions that have been done in science and society, a certain segment of those were done by people on the spectrum who think out of the box. Some people credit the whole genre of science fiction as being developed by people on the spectrum in the late 1800s and early 1900s. It's fascinating when you read this, that people who think differently lead us down different paths in inventions, in science, in music, in so many different ways.
Oh, I love that. My extended family, Asher, our son, he's the first autistic kid in the family, extended family that we know of. And so we've all been trying to learn as much as we can, and they've been so supportive. And my older sister said, she sent me a text after we did this little kind of lesson with the family, just some things we'd learned so far. And she said, you know, I bet every one of the world's greats in history was on the spectrum. Like, it's so amazing, you know, because of these intense interests and their just dedication to perfecting that one thing, which I love that. I thought it was really beautifully said.
Yes. And it's not always, you know, the people who have the most sophisticated language or write in sophisticated ways. So let me just share a very quick story. On our most recent podcast, one of our guests was an Ojibwe autistic woman from Minnesota. And she spoke about the fact that her uncle hardly ever spoke, probably he's passed away now, but probably was probably would have been diagnosed on the spectrum, but he was respected in this Native American community for his beadwork. And I guess somebody who's an expert in beadwork just wrote a book about him with lots of photos of his work. And she said, you know, there's not even a term for disability in the Ojibwe language. We just embrace people in our community. And my uncle definitely was on the spectrum. He hardly spoke, but he had this incredible talent and was highly respected for that.
Yeah. In a way, we're just embracing excellence. How hard is that? Right?
Right. And creativity.
And creativity. Yeah. No, that's wonderful. Do you have any final thoughts you'd like to leave with us?
I think, you know, it's just, I always like to encourage parents of very, very young kids, you know, to say that there are no limits. There's no ceiling here. It's all about really, really supporting your child, connecting with your child, expanding upon the enthusiasms, you know, trusting your gut, connecting not only with other parents, but connecting and learning from autistic people. Now, you know, with some autistic people, you're going to say, no, that's not relevant for my kid. I don't agree with that. But, you know, you're talking about people who in many cases have gone through years of the experiences that your child is experiencing now. That's so important. And to work on diversity, keep on educating the public that, you know, difference is okay. You know, it's okay to look at things differently while we are supporting kids and being successful in the mainstream.
Dr. Prasant, where can people get your book, Uniquely Human?
On Amazon. From my publisher, Simon & Schuster. A little plug here also. It just came out a few months ago in the updated and expanded edition.
Mm-hmm.
The original was 2015. It just came out a few months ago. But with the first one, I was not given the opportunity to do the audiobook. This one I did.
Oh, great.
So I narrate the audiobook for the revised and expanded edition. And it truly is revised and expanded, almost 100 pages longer, many, many more stories. Also, listen to our podcast. We have the most amazing guests. And my co-host, Dave Finch, who's autistic,
right,
and an audio engineer. He's doing his enthusiasm. He's as funny as can be, and we have a good time.
He is funny. No, thank you so much. Thank you for joining us. I've learned so much. I love the book. And, you know, our podcast is sponsored, but it's not sponsored by this, so I get to say whatever I want, which is amazing. And that's an unsponsored plug is what that is. So Uniquely Human, and yeah, I loved it. And then Uniquely Human, the podcast, wherever you get your podcasts, right?
Exactly, yes.
Okay, well, we look forward to what you do in the future. We can't wait to watch.
Thank you so much, Debbie. This was a pleasure.
Thank you. And Celebrating the Spectrum is a KSL podcast.